Hey, Fixing for Everything fans, it's Tom here. I hope you're all safe and well out there in this new world. This episode was recorded before the lockdown, before the pandemic even started. And if you can remember such a thing, Lee Clark was our guest in this week's episode, and he joined us live from Parents Evening when we were allowed to go out and do things. Lee is the founder of the fundraising platform GivePenny, and he is a fundraising whiz and expert, and has worked with loads of different charities launching loads of different events over the years. So he shares his life lessons, his determination to get fundraisers' grit back into the sector. And Lee defines what he means by grit and explains why it's such an important part of the fundraising world. It powers our creativity, our risk-taking, and allows us to try new things, which I think right now is a super important lesson. So Andy and I were really honored to be joined by Lee live from Parents Evening. He shared some great insight, so do take a listen, enjoy, and obviously let us know if you have any questions. Happy listening.
Hello and welcome to Fixing Fundraising. Today we're joined by Lee Clark.
How's it going?
Yeah, well, thanks. Yourself?
Yeah, I'm all right. I'm all right. I'm better than all right. I'm fair to middling, as they say, from where I'm from.
Fair to middling. Good. That's not bad.
So Parents Evening didn't go that well then.
No, Parents Evening was good, and there was a lot of talk of grit, actually. Ironically.
Excellent.
Ah, nice.
And that's what you want to talk about today.
With that excellently framed tangent, do you want to start us off?
Yeah, I wanted to talk to you guys about grit. It's something that, from a personal perspective, the last 10 years or so has been a very big part of my working life.
Mm-hmm.
And in my personal life too. And I've seen things over the past few years in the growth of GivePenny, talking to lots of charities, their fundraising teams, their marketing teams, their finance teams, all the teams. It's been like a team off. I've seen a lot of examples where the teams have got the grit to get stuff done, and then I've seen examples where a lack of it has meant that a perfectly good idea that just needed a bit more work fails or falls by the wayside, and it's a shame when that happens. So I wanted to talk to you about grit, and when you guys have kindly allowed me to come on and talk about it, it's also made me reflect a lot. So yeah, I was hoping we could talk about grit and determination and its role, I suppose, in what we do in this wonderful third sector.
Nice. Do you want to just start by quickly defining what it is that you mean by the word grit? Because I know it's used in a few different contexts.
Yes, it's not like a medieval porridge.
No. Or the thing they use to salt the roads when it's a bit icy.
We've never got enough of that, to be fair.
So, yeah, I suppose my definition of grit is the attribute, the characteristic that is needed to stick at something. And not give up. So yeah, the idea that something may be challenging, and with the application or presence of grit, the challenge is overcome.
Nice. So your hot take, as it were, is that a lot of fundraisers give up too easily on good ideas.
Yes. And I come from, GivePenny's a tech startup. It's the very definition of a failure constantly. we're building things all the time and then saying to the world, do you want this? We've had this idea. Do you like it? I've sat in front or stood in front of investors and pitched the idea of GivePenny years ago before it became a real thing. I've talked to directors of fundraising and charity CEOs and everybody in between about some of the ideas and concepts that we've come up with and developed as part of the fundraising platform. And a lot of that kind of educated guesswork and then followed by constant iteration means that you face failure an awful lot. And so it's a very familiar process to me, the idea that something doesn't work out, that's okay, you just keep going. And yes, there's always a time to admit that you should give up, and there's a lot of merit in the idea that it can be more efficient decision to say this just doesn't work. But in my opinion, I have seen so many examples of people falling at the first hurdle and then thinking, "Ah, well, the idea is broken," when in fact it's not that. It's the attitude to the failure in front of them, and it's driven by fear, I think, unwarranted fear. But sometimes it's driven by maybe a cultural thing at a given organization that you've got to do it. You've got to do it right first time. And how many of us ever get something right first time? I don't think I've ever solved a Rubik's Cube. you don't get something right first time. Whereas some of the best ideas, both in the charity sector and outside, have come from constant failure that eventually has turned into something great. Normally because of the personalities behind it, the people that have stuck at it and tried and tried and tried again. It's a thing I've recognised in the sector that I'd love to see fixed. I'd love to see it almost. I think it's Nikki Bell that talks about the idea of failure and how we should embrace it and all that kind of stuff. That's absolutely a thing that I think in our sector we could do with. There's a reason I've gravitated towards setting up a business that does some good rather than set out to create a charity that does some good. And it's because the behaviours that a commercial organisation have in the idea of taking risks, investing in things, not being worried if things don't work, just adjusting, twisting, pivoting and moving on. And moving forward at a pace is a thing that's attractive to me. Whereas, unfortunately, I had my fears confirmed to me in some of the earliest days of Givepenny when I'd speak to charities and say, "I've had this new idea and I would just love to help you." And this was just an offer of free help or a way of saying, "Look, let me give you an hour of our time just to explain this new idea that doesn't exist and we want to show the world that we'd love for you to be part of the journey."
Yeah.
It's like trying to turn an oil tanker, and we're like one of my co-founders says that we're like a flotilla of speedboats compared to some of the organisations that we've spoken to. It just gets to a point where you realise that if we'd have been culturally that way, we wouldn't have got anything done. We'd have just created another fundraising platform that does exactly the same thing as all the others. And we have to be the exact opposite of that in order to be successful. So, yeah, in a roundabout way, that explains a little bit about, I suppose, how I've encountered examples of where grit being present has helped, and also points out, it makes it clear as day to me that it's not there enough with some other organisations in this sector. And really, it could be a revolution of almost a startup-y kind of mindset in the charity sector. I mean, we talk about the top 2,000 charities being the hugest, right?
Yeah.
There's 160,000 small charities that, having met some of them, and I don't think I'll ever get, I'd love to get around to them all and talk to them about what's the mission that they're on and all that kind of stuff. But they're founded by passionate people that have all the control.
Yeah.
And they weren't afraid to go, this is a mission we should be on, let's go and do something about it. Some of that kind of purpose, accompanied by grit, seen in maybe some of the, you know, top 5,000 charities, wouldn't go amiss, I don't think.
I completely get, as someone that's worked in the tech for good industry, and as someone that's kind of, I completely get where you're coming from, that
the advantages that a lot of tech-based businesses that have in that world is that agile approach. And they're very quick to adapt and move and learn. And I think there are aspects of that behavior in the charity world, and sometimes they're really siloed. So like an events team, for example, might be really fast to learn on its feet because they have to quickly iterate on an event to make it better. But it's they're operating in a silo, whereas actually they don't have that kind of buy-in more widely within their organization. Like there's a blocker somewhere, whether it's at the C level, whether it's your trustees, whatever it may be. What I guess my question is for you, Lee, what the organizations that you've worked with that are like, that you put on a pedestal, what kind of characteristics did they exhibit that you like, other than obviously showing grit? Like what else comes with that? Like, are they less risk averse? Like what kind of behaviors do they exhibit that you're like, I wish everyone did that?
Beg for forgiveness, don't ask for permission. But far and away, that type of behavior, whilst it can result in some tense conversations, ultimately, if you're begging for forgiveness, you're in a position where you've done something that you were confident that was worth doing, and it may or may not have produced the result you hoped it would, but you've definitely learned something. There's always something to be gained from trying something new. Now, that doesn't mean you should try everything new. There's not enough hours in the day. We shouldn't all go to work in flip-flops. You know, there are days where you're quite often, I've found in the teams that I've really enjoyed working with, that have that initial decision to take on something new. It might be the decision to work with GivePenny on something. It might not. It might be the decision to even consider taking on, or maybe doing an event for a second time in a given year. So there's a gap in it. It might be, we don't raise enough money in February every year, so what should we do? Well, what would happen if we ran a 5K and somehow got permission to do it in the local park? What challenges would we face? What's the potential upside? What could we learn? Then organising a small event and getting people involved and raising a bit of money as a way of testing it before then saying to maybe the powers that be in an organisation, I've already done it. Look, it did this. Can I have a bit more budget so I can go and do a bigger version? That kind of behaviour, I think, is key to getting new stuff off the ground. With innovation as well, I've almost seen an over-organisation. So you've got whole teams of people in the innovation that seem to struggle to move anything forward. And you're like, it's almost like there's an over-process of bureaucracy involved in it. Like, I can't try this idea until it's been seen by 7 people and signed off, and that one has to be in red ink, and this one has to be in blue ink, and this one needs a small print. You know, and it's like, what, you know, innovation should be fast-moving. You should break stuff. I hate to invoke any Zuckerberg on this conversation, but he had a point very early on in Facebook's life before it became the shitbag that it is. He had a point. Move fast and break things.
Yeah.
And we've applied that. We applied that in the early days, and you know, I think he's quoted as saying that he got to a point where some dudes in the development team wanted to test the security vulnerabilities of a particular part of the system, and so took down half of Facebook while it was live to demonstrate the vulnerability. And so it was one of those tipping point moments where they went, right, okay, we'll change this, let's move back and break things, but with a little bit of a plan.
Yeah.
So... There's some merit in that, but yeah, that's another. Oh man, I don't want to be on a rant or a gripe for the entire podcast, but yeah, it's the idea that innovation teams, should that be a thing? I mean, I don't even know if that should be a thing.
There's a really good blog post by Wayne Murray on it about how if you have if you have a team whose dedicated job is innovation, it makes everyone else feel that innovation is outside of their job. And how that's, that team do the innovating.
They innovate, yeah.
Yeah, and I do exactly what I've always done. And when the innovation team come knocking, I tell them to fuck off. And it's a really good piece about how actually, if you're going to innovate, you need to empower everyone, not just one random desk of people. And I think,
how do they get that job?
Well, they'd be innovative.
Yeah. Yeah. By the way, I should say, let me not dehumanize these people. People who work in innovation have an appetite and a thirst, and there'll be a lot of pride attached to the idea that their job's to sit there and try and come up with new stuff. And I think that's great. Yeah. In itself, that's brilliant. It's just that I don't recognise a lot of them are people that have come. Ironically, you mentioned events teams. I think a lot of it comes from events fundraising, because there's such a we just got to get this done kind of attitude to it, and then there's like a peak and a postponement element to it, because it's on a given day or in a given month, and the kind of beginning, middle, end to every season. And I think that probably means that, a lot of the people I've met in the innovation teams within a charity have come from that kind of background and that behaviour. I don't want to sound like I'm,
No, because it definitely can work really well, right? But
yeah, it can. And we've seen great stuff, right? Across the whole sector, we've seen innovation teams that have been asked to come up with a new idea in X, and then they come up with a new idea, and it's great. I've also seen innovation teams that are lazy and don't produce enough, and there's not enough out. There's not enough like screwed up bits of paper and half-eaten apples on the floor when you walk in the office. There needs to be that energy, and you just see paperwork and email trails and people arguing on a 15-person email thing about something that shouldn't even be on someone's desk that day. And it's like there's too much process here. It's more like a governance team or a finance team in its behaviour, in that it's got to be, I's dotted and T's crossed. So yeah, you ask and you got an answer.
What is your suggestion if that resonates with someone? If they feel like their organisation doesn't necessarily have that grit, doesn't have the permission to do things and ask for forgiveness afterwards, what advice do you have for that fundraiser?
If they're a revolutionary, it's possible to change any organisation from within. I think the idea of an intrapreneur has always been exciting to me. There's no reason an extremely large organization can't have a whole bunch of entrepreneurs across all departments. Someone who's obsessed with process might come up with a fantastic concept for how a charity receives payment. They might be the person that finally gets the charity to agree to implement something like Stripe, and come along with the rest of the world or something on those lines. Entrepreneurship is important. I think if that's the type of person that you are, then don't be afraid to use that superpower in a large organization to try and change the culture. It might be that the mission you are on means that you find yourself at the charity that you are, and that you can have the biggest impact there, and that your work, your legacy will be in being as entrepreneurial as possible in that organization and trying to change the culture. That's how leaders are born, I think, having that impact. There's not one silver bullet that I can give that would mean that, if everybody does it, then you'll be in a great place. I think that if you're the type of person that exhibits that behavior and you find yourself in a situation where the culture needs a shift, then you can apply your natural skills and entrepreneurial thinking to anything, and see if that see if that causes the chaos effect and the butterflies winds on one side of the world mean that you end up with a rainstorm somewhere else. but then the other piece of advice, if you're not that type of person and you're not up for that fight, vote with your feet. Find an organisation that you love and take your talent there. I think that there are some fundamentally broken organisations, and if you don't feel like you can have the impact that would mean that getting out of bed every day is a joy, and going to work and working in this, you know, incredible sector thing, vote with your feet, find somewhere else. There's plenty of organisations that would love a person like you. It's looking for an organisation that would give them the freedom to let loose and create some cool shit, get on with it.
There's also an element of like, I've found this as working as a fundraiser, there's that kind of option of like collective action as well, like find like-minded people within your organization, regardless of kind of how big it is find people that have also had ideas where they've been told you're not supposed to have ideas, or they've been told, you know, we're not here to innovate right now, we're here to do X, you know, deliver on this deliverable. It's find other people that have shared that experience. Sometimes they'll be outside of your organization, and that's the joy of the fundraising community, is you can meet people who having the same battles as you are in a different organization, but just as often sometimes they work around the corner from you, and if you're in like a medium-sized organization, they're going through the same struggle sometimes silently. So it's finding those same kind of people who are thinking, oh, we could do this so much more differently, or we could be brave here and chop and change this. And sometimes it's just having the courage to have that conversation, which is sometimes like such an easy win, but it sometimes is the thing we least want to do when we come to work. And there are definitely like-minded people in other organizations, but you might find you're surprised that that person in finance, like you say, has come up with this great idea about changing, you know, payments forever, but they just haven't quite had the courage to talk to one of their colleagues about it. But that's, there's also
no other sector I've been a part of. I've had involvement with the technology sector, for example, and the business-to-business technology sector.
Yeah.
No other sector. In the third sector, everybody talks to each other, and no one's afraid to kind of share their experiences. And you know, you don't hear two IT companies going, you know, for coffee, you know, and like just having a chat and saying, how are you getting on? Oh, I'm having a nightmare with this, or I'm succeeding with this. Have you tried it? You know, you don't hear of that in other sectors, and it's one of the brilliant things. You know, long may that continue. So yeah, I'd agree with that.
Yeah, and there's an evolution of that, I guess, is turning that into turning that kind of sense of community that already exists into, I don't know if collective action is the right word, but like having that kind of innovation, you know, not like
the water cooler, comrades,
not like unionizing necessarily. And but that whole idea of using the word revolution, be like, there could be an innovation revolution if more people spoke about that than spoke about, like, and I guess there are people like Nikki Bell and others who are enabling that conversation by talking about failure, because one of the greatest ways you innovate is by being open and honest about failure and being like, here's why this didn't work, and here's the granular detail of why it failed, so you don't have to make the same mistake I did, but you can build on my foundations for free, you know. And we give away so much in the sector
And you know, the other thing as well is I think that there's a lot to be said for two other places in this. So there's the leadership in an organization, regardless of whether that was one of the original founders or whether they are stewarding a very large or older organization. Their behavior is so important and has such an impact. And I think that charity CEOs and trustees and board members and leadership within those organizations, they all meet up as well.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of that behavior that's good. The other area is the media. I mean, I'm always up for a scrap, and I hope one day that I get to talk to anybody influential in the mainstream media about the idea that a charity shouldn't invest in new ideas, because it will be a fantastic scrap. I think one of the fundamental things that has to change is how people, how the general public perceive the behaviour of a charity that receives income from them.
Mm.
I love the idea of transparency. That's not seen in other industries as much.
Mm.
Proactively producing, you know, a report, an annual report every year, and go, look, this is how we invested our money. I'd love there to be an entire section in every annual report of a charity organisation that went, and we failed doing that, 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 and that. And as a result, we've learned this, this, and this, which meant that we are going to do this next. And it cost us this much money.
Yeah.
And that means in 2 years' time, we're hoping to have this, but we might not. And that bit's missing.
Yeah, for sure.
That bit's totally missing. And there's a judgment on how much should be spent, you know, a proportion of income should be spent on X, Y, and Z. That needs to be thrown out of the window as well. Mm. Because every organisation is different. And how they're led is different. And what they spend their money on is should be different. Mm. And I'm it's an open invitation. If anybody wants to have a scrap about that,
I will buy tickets for that fight.
Should we make that the podcast episode title?
Yeah.
Lee Clark is willing to fight you.
I only know very, very, very junior journalists who won't want to fight you.
Shut up, I'll take them off.
But I am waiting for that moment where I don't know, it might be something as let's put in quote marks. I'm doing air quotes for those of you that can't imagine air quotes. It's the two finger bunny ear thing, isn't it? I'm doing air quotes. So the fundraising platform taking fees thing I'll always talk to anybody about how that's justified and why it should be there and how it's used and that kind of stuff.
It's the Dan Pilotta piece, right? I mean, we should probably have a Dan Pilotta mention Foghorn, but of how, like, why is it, why can you sell loads of guns and make loads of money and not be criticized for that? But if you make money from helping charities raise money, suddenly you're a monster.
Yeah, you're a complete monster. How dare you take the money? It's like, no, we're not taking the money. We're being paid it.
Yeah.
I'm not afraid to say we're being paid this. On a risk, but you know, we only get paid if a donation happens, right? And this, you know, as you know, it's been behaviour that until very recently was quite common. You know, the idea that something happens and that's when the service gets paid. So PayPal and go cardless and Worldpay and Stripe and anyone else who's processing payments gets that. Fundraising platforms. All with our different business models, we happen to still be in that place where we're going, you know what? We are investing everything into creating really cool stuff that helps people raise more money. It's not free.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Some of the stuff that we've developed doesn't exist anywhere else in the world on the internet. So we need to be able to cover the cost to have that present. And then cover the cost of the next innovation so that we can continue to test new things and help charities raise money in new ways. I've forgotten the main point I'm making here, but the idea that you have these things in place that ideas need to be communicated in a way that educate the public.
Yeah.
And I think that would then make it easier for charities at a cultural level, both from leadership all the way through the organisation, wouldn't feel so scared about doing stuff and trying new things and staying with it for longer than they would do normally. Because one thing I've learned with GivePenny is that there have been a couple of moments in the startup's life where it's just been like, oh my God, you know, I don't think we're going to get through this.
Yeah.
But you just keep going and you just keep finding a way and then bang, you know, you build something cool that someone uses, it makes the press, you end up stop calling. You know, we had been a moment last year where a couple of major charities rang us and said, what you're doing is great, can we talk to you? And we've been trying to talk to them for ages. And it's like, yeah, we've never heard of you. And you're like, oh God, I've been shouting for so long. it's important. I think for us to get to a point where you as a culture, as an organisation, as a sector, we could all do with that grit, because my experience of it has definitely been that if you show a bit of grit, if you're not afraid to fail, if you just keep going and just, you know, you take the bumps and scrapes along the way and you just get up and keep fighting, there's something good at the end of it always, even if it's a life lesson. Life lesson being the confirmation prize for pretty much everything. So, yeah.
Nice. Should we cut part one there?
Yeah. Love it.
What's the jingle this time?
What is the jingle this time? We've reached question time, Lee. It's time for questions. That's good.
There you go.
There we go. That's the question time jingle. It changes every time we do it. I guess you've kind of touched on this already, but is there a blog or a website, a book, a training course, something amazing that you've relied on in the past to get things done that you'd recommend that our listeners check out?
Yeah. Next question.
Yes, and it's a trade secret.
So there's a podcast that I fell in love with a couple of years ago called Masters of Scale.
Okay.
It's by a guy called Reid Hoffman, and he's one of the founders of PayPal.
Right.
It's just not a divvy, like good old Musk. So Reid interviews a lady called Nancy Lovely, and right. She's the CEO and founder of Crisis Text Line.
Cool.
And she scaled three not-for-profits in the States. Mm-hmm. So that was Dress for Success, DoSomething.org, and Crisis Text Line.
Yeah.
Now, that entire episode where Reid interviews Nancy is all about grit.
Mm.
And there are kind of people popping in there and about during the episode. They're in long form, so they're a good hour and a half, some of the episodes. There's loads of kind of tidbits to be able to take from those conversations. And that particular episode is the one. It's all about having a plan A, but having a plan B, plan C, plan D, plan 7. You know, it's about just continuing and just keep going, because something is there if you go through the process.
Nice.
So yeah, that one.
That's fab. We'll make sure we pull that link out and put it in the description as well, so people can listen to that. That's cool.
Is there anyone you see, or any example of anyone like really smashing it out of the park when it comes to having grit in the sector?
So I've been thinking about this one, and I've been thinking to myself, well, should I find a specific example? Hmm. Or bearing in mind there's no such thing as an original idea, right? should I mention a few organisations that don't seem to be afraid of trying stuff and then failing and what have you. Mm-hmm. I think most of the top 100 charities at least the top 100 fundraising charities that require the public to go out and fundraise for them over the last 2 or 3 years have tried something, and that should be celebrated.
Mm.
So the idea that something like, I don't know, let me think of something that's nothing to do with Give Penny on purpose, so that it doesn't sound like we sponsored this episode, because we can't afford that.
I can't even afford a Rubik's Cube. That's why you can't finish one.
Take British Heart Foundation's My Marathon.
Mm.
So that's a virtual marathon. I think it's like 3 or 4 years old or something on those lines.
Yeah, it's about that.
That was a standout success. I think of the lady, Leah Mace, I think. Forgive me, Leah, if that's wrong. She was a big part of that. I met her a couple of years after it started and learned all about how that had gone through the process. And there were failures along the way.
Yeah.
But they just kept at it, kept trying different things. That format for a given event, I think, has then been almost a permission slip for charities to then try a version themselves.
Mm.
So I think it, smashing it out of the park in this area of grit is to everybody who did more than one of the same virtual marathon. Let's go with virtual marathon people.
Yeah.
So they did it once, but did they do it again? And if they did it again, did they change anything? And that they're guaranteed to have blood all over their knees because they fell over constantly when putting all that together, because virtual marathons aren't easy.
Yeah.
And there's been a lot of people going, well, I tried this and it didn't work. And it's like, well, how many times did you do it? And tell me the journey. And you hear that they spent nothing on promotion. And you're like, well, no one signed up because no one knew it was there. So yeah, let's say that we should celebrate everyone who tried something more than once. And especially the people that did virtual marathon stuff.
Nice. To those people.
If you could unthink an idea, if you could wish that no one had ever thought of something, you could just remove it from the world, what would that idea be that you would unthink?
The idea that we have a 5-day working week that operates between 9 and 5.
Boom!
Amen. Done.
It's total bullshit that we all have to sit in traffic at the same time every day. In fact, given that it has been parent evening this evening, let's extend that to schools as well.
Yeah.
There is no good reason we all get to work at the same time. There are certain industries, certain job roles, yes, I get it, but there are too many examples of organisations and whole sectors that choose 9 to 5. Too many examples of bosses that think that because you were present, you did your job. I'm a big proponent of the idea that, you know, the idea that there's a guy who comes to fix your boiler if it breaks, and if he turns one screw, you should pay him lots of money, even though it took him 30 seconds, because there's 25 years of experience or whatever that's gone into knowing it was that screw that needed turning that fixed your boiler, whatever. I think we should never have allowed ourselves to go, no, this factory and how we've always run it, let's do that with offices.
Yeah.
Let's do that with shops. Let's do that with it just bothers me. So 9-5 is bullshit. That should be the title of the next podcast.
Nice.
I love that. That's good. If you were followed around with a sign above your head every day, what would it say, Lee Clark, and why? It can be double-sided if it helps.
You have permission on one side.
Yeah.
And get on with it.
Nice. This double-sided thing's really taking off.
Yeah, it is.
You can flip it based on your mood. You know, just get on with it. I love that.
Or replace that with a parrot, like a parrot on everybody's shoulder that just repeated, you can do it.
Yeah, nice.
You can do it. Although maybe not an annoying parrot. Maybe we could like swap parrots as we go.
Yeah.
They have like different accents. But look, a Scottish parrot, I think you can do it. And then there'll be like a Welsh one.
Wow. I am really into these parrots now. Yeah. But this question has turned a whole new life of its own.
This question has never gone this tangential, but I'm into it.
As with all new techniques for things, they wear off after a while because they're seen as routine, so you'd have to have an entire like army of parrots.
If you swap parrot often swap. Enough,
yeah,
it'll keep fresh.
Yeah, you got to keep those parrots fresh.
They all
fresh.
Say the same thing. They all say you can do it.
Nice. I can get behind that parrot.
Yeah. Well, he'd be on your shoulder. You'd be next to him.
Well, you can't get behind it.
Can't get behind it.
When you turn, it turns.
It turns with me. Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm with you now. Yeah.
Lee, the last formal question is very formal. What is your favourite joke?
I put so much petrol in my car the other day, I couldn't get in it.
I don't get it.
I was trying not to laugh because I was just watching Andy's face and he was like, I'm trying to work this one out.
I still don't get it.
As in the car, petrol in the car.
I'm dumb. Cool.
the liquid level of the car.
Yeah,
so
got it. Thank you.
It's a very old Dick Bob joke.
Nice.
I cried with laughter the first time I hit it. I was one of the people who got it straight away in a room of other people who hadn't got it, and they were looking at me like, what? What? And then you could see the penny drop with each one of them.
So, nice.
The Mick and Bob joke.
That's good. It's not. And last but not least, Lee, where can our lovely listeners find more of you on the interwebs?
On the interwebs,
yeah.
I can be found on the Twitters, at GivePennyLee.
Brilliant.
So at GivePenny, L-E-E. GivePenny.com, obviously. We, as you can probably gather, we're not enormous, but we do love what we're doing, and it's fun. And we want everyone along for the ride. So if anybody didn't know who we were before this podcast, go ahead and have a play with it. The idea that, you know, we all have this fun playing music on things like Spotify or tracking our steps with Fitbit or using Strava to go running or any or live streaming video games with YouTube and on Mixer and Twitch and all this stuff. All these experiences are fun, and we try and create weird and wonderful fundraising challenges using those existing fun experiences. Give us a go if you've not tried it. And I, for one, would love your feedback. I regret saying this, but we're still at the stage where when you get an email from GivePenny, it's obviously an automated email when you get a donation through on your fundraising page or confirming whatever's happening. You know, maybe it's the last day of your challenge, and we're just giving you a bit of a G up. If you reply to those emails, they come to me, and I still take the time to reply to as many of them as I can. And it surprises people and delights them. And so, yeah, there's always that way of getting hold of me. On the Twitters, on our website, and reply to an email that you get from GivePenny, and I'll do my best to come back to you.
So if
don't ask me any jokes, though.
If you're a journalist, it's up for a fight or a massifier of parrots. At GivePennyLee on Twitter. Got it.
If you're up for a bit of a verbal, then yeah. I do like it. I like replying to people because they often reply thinking that's an also an automated message. And somehow convince them I'm a human. So, yeah.
I love it. We'll make sure we put links.
Actually, that's an example of grit. We weren't sure what type of email journey or communication journey we should give people. And so powering through lots and lots of emails in the early days and replying to a lot of them, like a duck on a pond, you know, emailing fundraisers, asking them what they felt was missing, and that kind of stuff. That's all learning for us. And we just, you know, we've continued it now. We won't be able to do it when we've got billions of users, but yeah.
Nice.
Brilliant. Thanks so much for your time, Lee.
No, thank you, guys. I had a lot of fun. Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks.
Perfect.